Srimad Bhagavatam 8th Canto, Chapter 17, The Lord Agrees to Become Aditi's Son, Text 25.
Translation. Four verses until the end, because there's just a small purport at the end. Lord Brahma said, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, all glories unto you, who are glorified by all, and whose activities are all uncommon. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, O Lord of the Transcendentalists, controller of the three modes of nature. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you again and again. Next. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, the all-pervading Lord Vishnu, who have entered the cores of the hearts of all living entities. All the three worlds reside within your navel, yet you are above the three worlds. Formerly, you appeared as the son of Prishni. To you, the Supreme Creator, who are understood only through Vedic knowledge, I offer my respectful obeisances. O my Lord, you are the beginning, the manifestation, and the ultimate dissolution of the three worlds. And you are celebrated in the Vedas as the reservoir of unlimited potencies, the Supreme Person. O my Lord, as waves attract branches and leaves that have fallen into deep water, you, the Supreme Eternal Time Factor, attract everything in this universe. Purport. The time factor is sometimes described as Kalasrotra. Kalasrota, waves of time. Everything in this material world is within the time factor and is being carried away by the waves of attraction which represent the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Last text of the chapter. My Lord, you are the original generator of all living entities, stationary or moving, and you are also the generator of the Prajapatis. Oh, my Lord, as a boat is the only hope for a person drowning in the water, you are the only shelter for the demigods who are now bereft of their heavenly position. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 8th canto, 17th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Supreme Lord Agrees to Become Aditi's Son. Om Agena Timalandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sivasani Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Lord Brahma is offering his prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, you missed His Holiness Ramai Swami's beautiful explanation of the Nam Kirtan of Lord Brahma. Sometimes Brahma offers prayers in awe and reverence in terms of the majesty and opulence of Krishna. And he's doing that in these verses that you've heard, referring to the Lord in terms of his official capacities. Lord of the Transcendentalists, controller of the three modes of nature, you've entered the cores of the hearts of all living entities, all the three worlds reside within your navel, you're the supreme creator, you are the beginning, the manifestation, and the ultimate dissolution of the three worlds. You're celebrated in the Vedas as a reservoir of unlimited potencies. Your time, the supreme time factor. You're the original generator of all living entities, stationary or moving. You're the generator of the Prajapatis. You're the only shelter for the demigods. All this conclusive knowledge is far beyond conventional understandings of God. Yet, Lord Brahma can do much more. But first of all, let's talk about conventional understandings of God. Lord Brahma says, to you, the Supreme Creator, who are understood only through Vedic knowledge. Now, often it is said these days that if there's one thing people can't stand about religions, spirituality, however you want to call it, is exclusivism. The claim that only this way gives the best. Many people these days supposedly are turned off by that. Look, they offer many reasons. Isn't it true that all spiritual paths offer equal truths? And to say that one is the main focus, or to say that one is special, isn't that arrogant? Isn't that a bit over the top? And such spiritual practitioners are full of themselves. So let's examine, first of all, that point of view. Why are you stressing your doctrine? There are so many other doctrines. All doctrines are equal. They all make equal claims about the spiritual realm. Well, people today don't even have knowledge of Western philosophy. If they did, they'd immediately understand the fault in that statement, that all religions offer equal claims about the truth. That's a doctrine in of itself. In other words, as soon as you open your mouth, you're speaking some doctrine. Oh, they're all equal claims. Why should there be exclusivism? Well, why are you saying what you're saying? Do you have some superior knowledge that you can say all claims, all religious claims are equal? You must have some superior knowledge to talk like that, to get on that perch. So please tell us, what do you see from your perch? Where did you get your superior knowledge from? But they like to drag you down the ground. Aha, you're making exclusive claims. You're so retro, you don't understand that all spiritual paths make equal claims. All their claims about the truth are equal. Well, that's a religious statement. That's doctrine. Or else sometimes they say that the spiritual reality is like an elephant. You know, the old blind man and the elephant example. One religion talks about the trunk of the elephant. Another religion talks about the legs of the elephant. So each religion just gets a tiny bit of the ultimate reality. So in other words, it's better to stay away from any particular spiritual path because you'll only get just a limited vision of the absolute truth. Now, in order for you to make that statement that each religion is just focusing on one particular part of the elephant, no religion can see the whole picture. In order to say that, you must be seeing the whole picture. Otherwise, how would you know that each religion is just focusing on one aspect of the elephant? You must see the whole elephant. If so, tell us about the whole elephant. Tell us the process by which you see the whole elephant. Otherwise, you'd never know that each religion is just focusing on a part. So in this way, you can easily pull their cards, so to speak. And this is standard Western philosophy, but because people don't study philosophy at universities anymore, they're all worried about, I got to get a job, so I got to study something that brings in the money. So even the classic Western understanding of a liberal arts education and humanities, that's all out the window. I remember at the University of Auckland, 10 years ago, they graduated 5 philosophy majors, and since then it's been downhill. And they did a checkup on what those philosophy graduates were doing. One was a car mechanic, one was painting houses. 2 were unemployed, and they couldn't find the other one. So, therefore, you hear from people things that sound so eloquent, and those things may rattle your cage a bit. Ooh, I'm an exclusivist. I'm just focusing on Krishna. We're presenting bhakti as the topmost. Isn't that a major fault? Maybe we should just tone it down a bit in honor of these very sacred axioms that these people are presenting. All truths are equal. All religious claims are equal. If we all just see a bit of the whole picture. No. If you're sharp, with common sense, And so much of Prabhupada's dialogues with devotees when they would mock challenge him, they're based on Shastra, and also he would just drill them in common sense. Just think what you're saying. You see the whole picture, so you can take the superior vantage point? Another one. Supposedly more sophisticated. In this postmodern age, we understand that every statement about reality is culturally conditioned. So you're taking on the Krishna cultural conditioning point of view. Someone else is speaking from the European cultural point of view. Someone may be speaking from the Maori cultural point of view. Every statement, every claim about the absolute truth, or actually anything, whether you say absolute, relative, whatever, these are all cultural conditioned perceptions shaped by your upbringing, your society. Scientists will say even shaped by your DNA through the process of evolution. On and on it goes like that. So again, you may start to shake in your tracks. Ooh, what am I going to say about that? Yeah, maybe I've just taken on some Krishnite cultural conditioning. What to do? But again, some rudimentary knowledge of basic philosophy tosses that out the window. If you say that all statements are relative according to your cultural conditioning, your statement's also relative. Now, what kind of culture are you coming from that causes you to make such a statement? In other words, if you talk about everything being relative, the person who makes that statement, the relativizer, is also relative. So you can't say anything. Because as soon as you open your mouth, you are making a culturally conditioned statement that everything... Every truth claim is culturally conditioned. Well, so be quiet then. We don't want to hear it. We don't want to hear any more cultural conditioned statements. So, Lord Brahma is speaking that you, the Supreme Creator, are understood only through Vedic knowledge. To understand that statement, you have to understand the goal of the Vedas. He's speaking from a realized point of view. Just like sometimes you're listening to Srila Prabhupada speaking to news reporters, and he seems to be not intersecting with what they say. That, you may get that impression because Srila Prabhupada actually, he's experiencing the Supreme Absolute Truth. He sees it. He's from a different world, and he's seeing a different reality, and he is not going to back down on the fact that reality exists. Well, actually, yeah, we're all right in some kind of way, and I can understand why you don't understand what I understand, but that's okay. We'll all have peace in the world anyway. He just doesn't come across like that. He comes across as someone who sees and knows and experiences what he's talking about, and that's upsetting to people. The same thing when they read Prabhupada's books. Sometimes, and you've heard it a little bit, some people will say, he's just too focused. He's just he's just too certain. It can't be right. It's just too certain. Someone was telling me that. You know, I feel uncomfortable with this. I mean, he's got no doubts. It's like, come on. If for something to be true, it has to have some holes to it. It has to be dodgy, and the person has to be wavering and a little unsure. So they say like that. What about the mystery of it all? As one famous New Age spokesman of 10 years ago, they go out of, in and out of style very quickly. He said, the soul doesn't want answers. The soul only wants questions. Questions that are never resolved. That is the eternal propensity of the soul. And of course people, ooh, that sounds really deep. The soul never wants answers. Only open-ended eternal questions. Wow, that's a spiritual path for me. But what about that path? And where does it lead? If you want to understand where you're going, you have to be able to see the whole reality. Another one, people say, all paths lead to the same goal. Well, how do you know? Can you see how all the roads are leading to the same destination? You're up in an airplane and you can see all the roads are converging. Whatever road you take from Kumeu, you'll get to Auckland. You must have some knowledge then. But if you're in the darkness and you're saying, all roads lead to Auckland, a ridiculous statement. You can't see. So by your saying that all roads lead to the same destination, no matter what path you take, you must be up in an airplane and seeing the whole scheme of things. So you can say that, well, if you take this road, it'll be roundabout, it'll go through the Y-Tex, and then it'll go out to Hamilton, and then it'll come back up to Auckland, but it eventually gets to Auckland. If you're up in a plane, you can see that. Well, this is the motorway, it goes straight to Auckland, you'll get there quicker. But where are you? Where are the people who are making these statements? They'll admit themselves are in darkness, but they want to shake you up and justify their own sense gratification. You see, there's no need to commit yourself to anything. Might as well just go on enjoying your senses like everyone else. Stop harassing yourself with all these exclusivist truth claims. So Brahma is speaking from a viewpoint of someone who's experiencing the goal of the Vedas. And he's offering his respectful obeisances, using so many beautiful names for Krishna, as we heard His Holiness Ramai Swami explained yesterday. As Brahma is chanting these names, he's giving knowledge. He's awakening your eternal relationship with Krishna by first getting to understand you're subservient to Krishna. That's a big step forward. We shouldn't make light of it. Of course, Brahma can go much further. And he's the head of our sampradaya. He's Adi Kavi, as the Bhagavatam describes him. He's the original scholar, the original professor, intellectual of the universe. And every morning we chant with Brahma, Govindam Adi Purusham Kamaham Vajami. In those Brahma Sahita prayers, he gives more intimate knowledge of Krishna. Venam Kanantam Aravindadhyadaksham. He's playing a flute. His eyes are like blooming lotus petals. Chintamani. He lives in Chintamani Dham, where all the ground is touchstone and the trees are desire trees and surrounded by gopis, goddesses of fortune. So Brahma can go deeper and deeper. When he was offering prayers to Krishna in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, after Krishna had bewildered him in the Brahma Vimohana Leela, Lord Brahma, in his prayers, he spoke more intimately of Krishna. First of all, he cleared out any possibility or any hope that you can understand Krishna through karma and jnana, through karmic activity and philosophical speculation. And he recited the famous verse, Atapi te deva padambuja dvaya. Only those who have just a particle of mercy from Krishna's lotus feet, they can understand him. Otherwise, it's not possible. Just a particle of that mercy from Krishna is enough to give you understanding. Otherwise, your efforts will be futile. In other words, we are dependent. Why do we act like being dependent is something so unusual? Material existence means you're always depending on someone or something. Just think about your life. It's totally wrapped up in dependencies. Either you call them dependencies or conditions. Same thing. Conditioned soul means dependent soul. But all living entities, all jivas, are dependent on Krishna. It's just that in material life, you're not conscious of how you're dependent on Krishna. And what happens? You end up being dependent on so many material conditions and materially illusioned people. And this way, Your status is so shaky, and it's so hallucinogenic, but you have pride. Why should I depend on Krishna? Who is Krishna? What's he got to do with my enjoyment? A bhakta, a devotee, happily cultivates dependency on Krishna, like a child happily cultivates dependency on the parents. You can study children who have good parents, and you can see they relish being dependent. It's a flavor that they're tasting. So why do we have this paranoia about depending on Krishna? Perhaps we're thinking, well, suppose this isn't the real truth. Suppose Krishna isn't the ultimate. Suppose it's all just the whatever, formless, qualityless, activityless. Suppose that's the case. How do you resolve those doubts? By hearing, by engaging your senses in devotional service, the picture of the Absolute Truth will become more clear to you. By following the path set by Lord Brahma, by chanting the prayers by Lord Brahma, gradually you'll be able to see the goal at the end of the road. Okay, you may not see the goal immediately right in front of you, but you can see down the end of the road is the goal. And that's quite extraordinary. It's like you're driving on the motorway to Auckland City, to the CBD. Now, you're not at the CBD yet, but you can look down the road and you can see the CBD's down the road. And all the signs are confirming, yes, yes, keep going. 20 kilometers is Auckland. So bhakti is like that. It doesn't simply give reassurance when you've attained the ultimate destination. Because, as we heard yesterday, actually the process of chanting Hare Krishna is the ultimate destination. The means are the same as the end. So it's not that when... Of course, when you reach Auckland City on the Northwest Motorway, then you give up the motorway and, okay, I'm in the CBD. But with Hare Krishna and chanting, when you reach the destination, you simply increase your chanting. You're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, heading toward the destination when you'll eternally hear Srimad Bhagavatam. You're engaging in devotional service now. You're heading toward the destination of non-stop, continuous devotional service. So in this way, even the neophyte, the beginning practitioner, is in touch with the ultimate reality, the ultimate destination. They're just varying degrees of completion of the journey, but the goal is straight ahead, and the means that you're adopting are eternal means that are ends in of themselves. So how can you beat that? What better can you find? In Brahma's prayers to Krishna, after clearing out, as we said, any hope that you can attain and understand Krishna through karmic activity and mental speculation, then he makes a proposition that, I want to be your servant. Please grant that whether now as Lord Brahma or in future births as Lord Brahma, I can be your servant. I can be your devotee. In fact, I don't mind even if I take an animal birth as long as I can be your devotee. He's expressing his desire for servitude to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then he begins to explain that there are more intimate relationships. And I can see that in Vrindavan. Because remember, when Brahma, at the start of the Brahma Vimohana Leela, when he thought he stole the calves and cowherd boys, he was wondering, this little blue boy, herding cows, eating lunch with his gopas, his cowherd boyfriends, is that really my worshipful Lord? Is that really Govinda Madhipusha? I don't know. The scene looks so intimate. It looks so personal. Maybe sometimes you get that feeling too. Krishna is just too personal. It's like, I want an area of my life which is my own. And I don't know about Krishna. He's just up so close. He's the self of the self. I don't have any private backyard in my heart. Krishna wants everything. We should find a spiritual path where there's some fences. Good fences make good neighbors. Okay, Krishna is the super soul in everyone's heart. Okay, fine. The Christians also say God is in everyone's heart. Okay, but Krishna, he doesn't give you any room to maneuver, it seems. He's so personal. He's so beautiful, all attractive. That's fine, but don't I need some space to live my own life? So, Brahma is asking for nothing but servitude, yet he had previously some doubt. This is too personal. The scene on the bank of the Yamuna River. Krishna had gone to look for the calves because while the boys were taking lunch, the calves had wandered far away. And so the boys were going to get up and look for the calves. But Krishna said, no, go on taking your lunch. I'll do it. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, whom you heard all these verses describe about in such an official, powerful, majestic way, he, is, as a little boy, is wandering through the forest of Braj with some yogurt rice in the palm of his hand, and he's looking for calves. So Brahma thought, I don't know, could be, maybe not, I'll make a test. I'll be empirical, I'll be a research scientist. I'll do something and that will verify, is this my worshipful Lord? There's no question of Brahma's being an atheist or an agnostic. It's just that he was overwhelmed by the personal sweetness of the scene. So he then thought that he took away the cowherd boys and the calves. When Krishna got back to the place after leaving the boys, he found the boys were gone, the calves were gone also. So Brahma, though, as you know, in a split second, he changed his mind. He thought, I don't know if what I did was a good idea. I could be tampering in Krishna's leela. In a split second, he changed his mind. But that split second was a year of earth time. So have some sympathy for Brahma. I'm sure you, like I said, okay, I think I'll move these cartels. No, they're fine with you. That's how quick Brahma changed his mind. But it was a year of earth time. So therefore, for 1 year, as you know, Krishna replaced all the missing calves and cowherd boys, and he himself was the replacement. Every mother in Vrindavan had Krishna as her little child, and she could nurse Krishna. Because all the mothers in Vrindavan were thinking, oh, Mother Yashoda, she's so fortunate. If Krishna were my son, I would also take care of him so affectionately. So they were longing in that way. So Krishna gave them their chance to have him directly as their son. And then the cows all had a chance to have Krishna as their calf. So, once this pastime was over, Brahma is confessing that I see this Vrindavan sweetness, and actually, this is what I want. Before he asks for that from Krishna, though, he offers very intimate glorification of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. He begins to describe fortune, bhagya. What is good fortune? What is bhuri bhagya? What is the greatest fortune? So he spoke about the breast milk of the ladies in Vrindavan who nursed Krishna, and the cow's milk coming from the cows to the calves who were also Krishna. How fortunate are they? And how nectarian was that milk? The Acharyas point out that you're not dealing with material bodies. The bodies of the cows, the bodies of the maternal gopis, they're Satchitananda. And, of course, Krishna's body is Satchitananda. So, therefore, that milk was eternally increasing in tastiness. And each time Krishna, as a calf or as a little boy, each time he sucked on the tit of the cow or the breast of the mother, the milk increased in bliss with each suck. This is the spiritual world. You're not dealing with biological secretions. You're not dealing with flesh. You're dealing with everything composed of the spiritual energy. So Brahma was remarking, how fortunate are these cows? How fortunate are these mothers? And just look at the ecstasy that Krishna was feeling. And then he commented about himself. Even the best Vedic yajnas, the best Vedic sacrifices could not give Krishna such pleasure. He's talking about all the formal yajnas that the demigods perform, just like Aditi just performed a vrat. And so Brahma's referring to that. All these yajnas, all these official ceremonies glorifying the Lord as creator, maintainer, and destroyer, they don't give him anywhere near as much pleasure as does the breast milk from the mothers and the milk from the cows. Then he goes from glorifying this Vatsalya Prem, love of Krishna and parenthood, because both the cows and the mothers in Vrindavan had a chance to treat Krishna as their child. Next he goes to Sakyaras, because in one sense you can say everyone in Vrindavan, or most entities in Vrindavan, they also have some friendship included in their relationship with Krishna. So Brahma points that out. Ahobhagya, ahobhagya, nanda gopa vajakasa. Yanmitram paramananda purnam Brahma sanatana. He has to say it twice. Oh, how fortunate. Oh, how fortunate are Nanda Maharaj and the cowherd boys and men of Vrindavan. Because they have as their eternal friend the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is unlimitedly blissful and who is, of course, eternal and perfectly complete, Purna. How fortunate are they? How fortunate are they? He's their eternal friend. The Acharyas point out, in other words, Brahma is saying, Krishna's relationship with Sri Dama, Sudama, all the gopas, that's eternal. Krishna's eternal. The cowherd boys are eternal. That's the inner meaning of that. So Brahma is glorifying it. How greatly fortunate, how greatly fortunate. These men and boys of Vrindavan have Krishna as their friend. Of course, Nanda Maharaj is more than Krishna's friend. He's Krishna's father. But Brahma is seeing within those relationships the element of friendship. And then he makes a plea that if I have any good fortune, I'd like to take birth as a blade of grass somewhere inside Vrindavan. Because I don't have any hope of getting mercy directly from Krishna, I need the mercy of Krishna's devotee. So if I take birth as a blade of grass in Vrindavan, then somehow or other, when the residents of Vrindavan walk around, some particles of dust from their feet will go on my head. And Srila Prabhupada in the Krishna book amplifies Brahma's statement. That he says, Brahma said, and of course, if I'm not able to take birth as a blade of grass in Vrindavan, let me take birth as a blade of grass outside Vrindavan. He's really begging and pleading. Because even outside Vrindavan, sometimes the residents of Vrindavan, they walk there, and sooner or later, I'll get the mercy. So, please grant me that good fortune, because they are so fortunate. But he also presented that actually we demigods aren't completely out of it. We have good fortune in Vrindavan too. How is that? As the 11 senses, because each demigod is lord of a particular sense or a particular sense object, as the 11 demigods in charge of the senses, we taste the honey-like nectar coming from Krishna's lotus feet. We taste that through the cups of the senses of the Brijvasis, because after all, we are demigods. We are in charge of their senses. So whenever the residents of Vrindavan see or taste or smell or touch, we demigods, we taste the nectar of Krishna's lotus feet through their senses, because we are the lords of the senses. Now, why is Brahma saying that? Because in Vrindavan, there's no control by demigods. That's in the material world, where anytime your sense interacts with a sense object, a demigod is permitting that to happen. So, why is Brahma speaking that he and the other devas, they're involved in the sense experiences in the spiritual world? First of all, why 11 senses he refers to? 11 demigods in charge of 11 senses. Well, first of all, let's count. There are 5 working senses, 5 knowledge-acquiring senses. There's mind, intelligence, false ego, and there's also citta, consciousness. So you get up to 14. But 3 are removed from the list. This is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gets technical. It's 14, but you knock it down to 11 because, first of all, the Lord of Consciousness is Vasudeva, planar expansion of Krishna. So take that off the list. Second and thirdly, the anus and genitals are low class, so take those off the list. So therefore, 11. So Brahma says, okay, the 11 senses of the residents of Vrindavan, there are 11 devas who are relishing the nectar of Krishna's lotus feet through the cups of the Brijvasis' senses. But he's speaking in ecstasy, actually. He's reading himself into the situation. Just like we control the sense activity in the material world, we got a connection in the spiritual world, too. We got things to do there. It's an ecstatic statement. It's not factual. But his bhakti is overwhelming him. So he's in-reading himself into Braj Leela out of ecstasy. I want to be there. I want to taste it. We're fortunate too. So actually, after he makes that statement, he makes a plea to Krishna that, give me a spot in Vrindavan somewhere. I know I can't approach your lotus feet directly. Put me somewhere that I can get the dust particles from your feet on my head, the dust particles of the feet of the residents of Vrindavan on my head. And then, as we said, Prabhupada amplifies it. Even outside Vrindavan, that would be fine too. The acharyas amplify it too. I'll be a stone on the path somewhere. He's really expressing the core of Brahma's desire. But now he has to, he wants to express some, a philosophical conundrum. And he is presenting that, the acharya said, in such a way that even Shiva and the Kumaras, the 4 Kumaras, have this question. They're bewildered by this. In other words, so don't think it's just me. This is something that none of us can understand. I'd like to present it to you. You are the embodiment of all benedictions. We all accept that. And especially you are the embodiment of all benedictions for the residents of Vrindavan. There's no doubt about that. But there's one thing that's bewildering us. Although that the residents of Vrindavan rightfully get. You, as the abode of all benedictions, we have seen that you gave yourself to Putana. You treated her like a devotee, even though she came to you as to kill you with poisoned breast milk. You gave yourself to her, and you gave her the status of a devotee. In fact, as Uddhava explains in the third canon of Bhagavata, you gave her the position in Vrindavan equal to your own mother, the same rasa. So, we don't understand this. Shiva doesn't understand. The four Kumaras don't understand. If you gave yourself to Putana, this hideous witch, I'm trying to kill you, what do you have left to give to the residents of Vrindavan who are always your eternally loyal devotees? This doesn't add up. So he presents that question to Krishna. It's a combination question and expression of ecstasy. Oh, just see this. He's given himself to Putana. Not only to Putana, but her family too. She had a horrible family. Bakasura. Who was the other one? She had someone else? Huh? Horrible family. So Brahma says, not only did you give yourself to Putana, but all her, but her brothers too, all hideous. So how can the position of the Brijvasis be so exclusive if you're just giving yourself like that? You should be giving them more. Okay, give yourself to Putana. That's your mercy. But these Brijvasis, for whom you're their heart and soul, what do you have more to give them? So he asks Krishna that. And Krishna responds that, Brahma, you don't understand that I know what my devotees will want in the future. I know it will satisfy the residents of Vrindavan completely. So I already gave myself to them, knowing that by giving myself to them, they'll be completely satisfied. They won't want anything more. I already knew that. I've already taken care of it. So Brahma thinks, all right, I accept that, that you're all-knowing, you perfectly know how to satisfy your devotees, how to reciprocate with your devotees. You're bhavagrahi, you are in the heart of every devotee, you know how to arrange for the satisfaction of their deepest spiritual desires. All right, I accept that. And you say that you already knew in advance what would fulfill them completely, and you've already given them what would fulfill them completely, so therefore, my question is not exactly precise or accurate, but I like to point out something humbly. By what you did to Putana, giving yourself to Putana and her brothers, you gave them yourself. And the Brijvasis, they love you so much. You're the everything for them. So therefore, actually what I see you've done is put yourself in a situation in which your only atonement is to be indebted to the residents of Vrindavan. You set yourself up. And the only way you can atone for giving yourself to such creatures like Putana and her family, the only way you can atone for it is to be ever in debt to the residents of Vrindavan. So, where does this indebtedness also enter into the Vrindavan picture? Let's look at our clock. Okay. Not going to make sure our question period doesn't go beyond the precedent that His Holiness Ramai Swami set yesterday. We have meetings at 10 o'clock. So, how else does Krishna get involved in indebtedness? Everyone knows that Krishna left the gopis in the middle of the night in the forest. He disappeared from them, and they became mad with separation. They were singing out to Krishna, crying out to Krishna with tears, playing musical instruments and singing with all kinds of melodies and rhythms, because the origin of all arts is the most intimate abode, Goloka Vrindavan. So while they're singing and playing instruments, performing dramas, acting out Krishna's pastimes as if they're Krishna, crying, at the peak of their desperation, Krishna suddenly appears again in the middle of the night. The full moon Krishna appears again. And seeing Krishna, it's like their senses came back to life again. They were like dead. And seeing Krishna, their prana came back to them. So they went with Krishna to the bank of the Yamuna. As they were walking, one gopi took Krishna's hand and put it in between her hands. Another gopi took the other arm of Krishna and put it around her neck. And that arm of Krishna was decorated with beautiful sandalwood paintings, because Krishna is a supreme artist. So these gopis actually were they were reverential. They had a streak of reverence. They were very submissive and subordinate to Krishna. They were agreeable, very agreeable in their dealings with Krishna. So they went to him and they took his hand, they took his arm. But there were some others that was not their leela. They were thinking, Vishnu Chakri Thakur says, we don't go to him, he comes to us. These were the famous left-wing gopis, predominated by Krishna's dearest consort. You heard my son yesterday talking about Srimati Radharani. She had a different approach, because it's her capacity to give Krishna the best pleasure by being contrary. Of course, in the mundane world, no husband can tolerate that. But Krishna is such the supreme enjoyer that he wants this. He relishes it. So he has consorts who are agreeable, and he has consorts who are very contrary and act in an unsubmissive way for Krishna's pleasure. So, while the group of Chandravali was treating Krishna with reverence amidst their Madhurya Ras, the left wing, led by Srimati Radharani, they had a different approach. And she set the pace, Krishna's dearest consort. She, while looking at Krishna, shot such arrows of anger at him. The eyebrows were like bowstrings, and her eyes were the arrows. And she was angry enough to be biting her lip. But she put her hands over her lips, bitter lips. Her point was, you left us, and now, just because you want to enjoy, you've come back, huh? This is hard for us to understand, because we'll input our material experience and our material conditioning into it. One has to be very careful in hearing of Krishna's leelas. Whether it's cowherd boys' leelas or gopi leelas, you have to be very careful to understand that there's not one trace of the material energy there. There are no mundane arrows of Cupid firing at all. This is all totally an experience on 100% the pure spiritual platform. And all the variegatedness in Krishna's devotees is happening to give Krishna pleasure. And they know what they're doing. They know what Krishna likes. So, his dearmost consort stared at him with anger and even bit her lip. Meanwhile, another consort of Krishna, she took advantage of the fact that Krishna was mesmerized by this angry glance from his topmost consort. In fact, the acharyas say Krishna was even trembling a bit and a little... So while his most intimate consort is giving him the angry look, then... others in her party, Lalita, she took the opportunity. Oh, Krishna's preoccupied. Now I can just stare at him to my heart's satisfaction, because he's not focused. He doesn't see what I'm doing. I can just look, and I can just look, and I can just look. And then Vishakha, who's also in Srimati Radharani's party, she took the opportunity to stare at Krishna, and then take Krishna through her eyes into her heart and embrace him there. And then she closed her eyes, thinking, he went away before, he left us in the middle of the night. Now I've got him in my heart, I've taken him into my heart through my eyes, I'll close my eyes so he can't escape, and I'll embrace him to my heart's content. And her bodily hair stood up in ecstasy. So, in this way, they arrived at the bank of the Jamuna, and the Jamuna River had already piled up sand, soft sand on the bank. The waves of the Jamuna River had done that. And so his intimate devotees spread their shawls, their top pieces, perfumed. And Krishna sat there, even though these cloths are used by them. Krishna accepted their asana that they had provided him. And so they began to massage Krishna's hands and massage Krishna's feet and speak a little sarcastically, the left wing. Oh, Krishna, your hands are so cool. Your feet are so cool that they put out the fire of our separation that we experience when you left us. They're actually speaking sarcastically. They're gradually, their anger was dissipating because, after all, Krishna's back. But there was a little trace there, the acharyas point out. So that was when they asked Krishna those famous questions. We won't go into detail in those questions today, but tell us, who is the best kind of lover? The one who reciprocates only when someone reciprocates with him, or the one who reciprocates no matter what the other person does, acknowledging or not, or the one who doesn't reciprocate at all? Tell us. In other words, Krishna, you left us. What kind of lover are you? But they wanted to pose the question very carefully, but they wanted at the same time to communicate to Krishna that, you know, why did you do this? So Krishna answered that, don't think I left you. Actually, I was always watching from a hidden vantage point. I wanted to see your praying-filled talks. And also, you should understand that there has never been devotees like you. There are never devotees like you. There'll never in the future be devotees like you. I know that, but I just wanted to increase your attachment. You see, when a devotee is attached to me, I reciprocate with that devotee by acting in such a way that the devotee will want me more and more. That's actually my reciprocation. The devotee is praying for pure love for me. Or in the case of a perfected soul, the devotee wants more intimate relationship with me. So I'm doing that, and this is how I do it. So the acharyas explain that this cuts two ways, both for the devotees striving for perfection and those who are already perfect. For the devotees who are striving for perfection, Krishna disappears so that they'll think, oh, just see what an offender I am. Just see, I have no Krishna conscious realization. Where is Krishna? What is the use of me? And in that humility, the devotee strives more how to please Krishna. And in that way, Krishna says, look, I'm fulfilling your desire. How can you blame me? You wanted pure love for me, so I'm arranging for your purification, so you have pure love for me. What's the problem? And then for the perfect soul, who already has nothing to purify, Krishna says, you wanted more attachment, more raga. Okay, I'm doing that. I leave you so that you can taste love of Krishna in separation. So please, he begged the gopis, don't reproach me. I know it could be said that I've done something wrong, but please don't consider me in that way. And then he told them that actually, who can repay? How could I repay your devotion? Even if I had the lifetime of Brahma, I couldn't pay my debt to you. In 311 trillion years, that's not enough time to repay my debt to you. Please be just satisfied with your extraordinary bhakti qualities, your unsurpassed bhakti qualities. You've given up your family, your friends, ordinary dharma, ordinary respect. That doesn't mean anything in the Western world these days. Honor, respect, social standing. Who cares? Everyone just wants instantaneous sense gratification. But in a civilized society that operates by Vedic mores and Vedic principles, there is a way to be respectable. There is a way to be dutiful. There is a way to act properly in society. So appreciating that, you can also start to appreciate the gopis threw all that away, their honor, their social standing. They left their families, husbands, children, fathers, everything, and just walked away from it immediately, ran away from it immediately at the sound of Krishna's flute. So Krishna says, I know that. How can I repay this? And then he points out a very interesting thing. Vishnathakura Thakura says, Krishna says, actually the truth is, I never gave up my own mother. I didn't give up my friends. I didn't give up my father. But you've done that. Therefore, I'm indebted to you because you've done something even I didn't do. I've kept Mother Yashoda. I've kept Nandamaraj. I've got my cowherd boys. I've got my friends. But you, you've given all that up for me. Therefore, I'm indebted to you. But finally, the gopis took it a different way. They said, actually, we were wrong to criticize Krishna. We were wrong to imply that he had done something inappropriate. Actually, now we understand that Krishna voluntarily has placed himself in a situation in which he's indebted to us. He's done that. He's made it so that he himself has an impossible debt to pay back. But he did it all. He put himself in that situation. That's how great the love of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is for his parts and parcels. So this is why Lord Chaitanya says, there's no better method of loving Krishna than that displayed by the cowherd damsels of Vrindavan. So if you want to understand pure love, then we must first become responsible to purify ourselves. And then, having attained a proper qualification, we can finally start to understand this realm of pure love. It is something to be qualified for, not something to aspire for from our low position. Sometimes, I remember in Los Angeles, devotees were caught up in this gopi bhava, thinking, since it's the highest, we should just be into that all the time. The leaders, our ISKCON leaders, have misled us. They are making us do ordinary activities like deity worship, book distribution, cleaning, salt farming, whereas the real nectar is the gopi bhava. And so that's what we should be focusing on. Why have the leaders of ISKCON deprived us of that? So it became a big dispute. I was there in L.A. for that. And so these devotees even went to see Prabhupada to argue with him. So, and Prabhupada definitely put them in their place. Most of them accepted, a few didn't. So they began to present to Prabhupada, isn't the gopi bhava the highest? And Prabhupada would roar back, but you are the lowest. But shouldn't we? Okay, we are the lowest, okay. You know, we should be humble. We understand, Prabhupada, we should be humble. Okay, but shouldn't we aspire for these highest levels? And Prabhupada gave the example. He said, why are you jumping like monkeys from the bottom, from the ground up to the topmost branch? You first become qualified. First you deserve, then you desire. But don't, from your monkey position on the ground, jump up trying to get the topmost branch. So in this way, most of them understood that. Because Prabhupada, he agreed, yes, this is the highest, but you have to go through the process properly to get to this highest level where you can actually understand what you're hearing. So we hope to discuss these things from a standpoint of not thinking we are at that level, but we're looking at such Leela of Krishna's from a respectful distance, acknowledging our status, the difference between those perfected devotees of Krishna and us, and we repeat the words of the acharyas from the standpoint that our position is unqualified and in need of Krishna's mercy. And just as Lord Brahma, he's the head of our sampradaya, he prayed, we pray for the mercy of the devotee, then we can understand Krishna. Who are we to try and approach Krishna directly? And Brahma understood, who am I to even approach the residents of Vrindavan directly? I just want to get the mercy of the dust of their lotus feet. He finished his prayers and Krishna was silent. What was Krishna thinking? Who is this four-headed Brahma offering me all these prayers? I'm just a cowherd boy. All right. Hare Krishna.